This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Hello again, I'm Peter Terzakian. It is March 15th, 2019. Welcome to another edition of our ARC Energy Ideas Podcast.
And I'm Jackie Forrest.
Great, Jackie. So we've got a number of things to talk about, and they're all related to capital investment in oil and gas companies, particularly talking about divestment by big financial institutions and how they have really escalated their criteria for investing in oil and gas companies and the effect that's having. So we are going to talk about a couple things.
Well, first of all, we're going to talk about the debate you were in, Peter, at Globe Capital in Toronto at the end of February. It was ARC Energy Institute versus Carbon Tracker. And the debate title was pretty controversial.
It sure was. I mean, it's be it resolved that investors in the fossil fuel industry are all doomed.
That's so, right. So what side were you on?
Well, I was I was countering the resolution that fossil fuel industry is not doomed was my view, investors in the fossil fuel industry. But that leads into the second topic we're going to talk about, which is The Economist magazine, which wrote an article on February 6th about the truth about big oil, gas, and climate change. It was an interesting article, and we felt it was important to counter some of the misconceptions or arguments that The Economist magazine was making.
Yeah, and really related to the whole divestment movement, and as The Economist always is, sensational. But I would say they didn't really get the truth right, so we want to want to debunk their arguments a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So why don't we talk about that debate first? I mean, it was a proper debate. It was 8 minutes each for the affirmative to the resolution and the counter to the resolution, and then standard 3-minute rebuttals and then closing arguments. Had a lot of questions from the audience, which was really fun. It was really great, very collegial, and I really felt that the audience learned a lot. So we want to talk about some of that stuff. But before we do that, like, you've also debated Carbon Tracker before.
Yeah, I had two debates prior, and I think it's been very constructive. I actually believe that it has actually affected their research agenda a bit, because after especially the first debate, they came out with some papers that actually addressed some of the points I'd made. Mm-hmm. But I think for our audience, we should give them a little more context to who Carbon Tracker is.
Yeah.
They really came onto the scene in a big way in 2011 when they published a paper called Unburnable Carbon: Are the World's Financial Markets Carrying a Carbon Bubble? And they had this picture of a bubble with a needle ready to burst the bubble.
Right, right.
And that cover, that paper got really widely distributed and read. And they argued that for global temperature to stay under the 2 degree of warming, most fossil fuel carbon reserves could not be burnt. Therefore, investors that were holding equities in these companies, their equities were overvalued because the future value of those reserves was not really going to be as high as what people thought.
Right.
And this is also sometimes called the stranded asset debate,
right,
that, you know, you have an asset, you think it's valuable, but it's a stranded asset. It'll be worth nothing in a short amount of time.
Right. Like a typewriter.
That's right. A typewriter. Although Peter might still have them. Most people consider them stranded assets at this point.
Yeah.
Now, some flaws with the original paper, I believe, is they included all carbon is equal. That no matter what fossil fuel you're investing in, the risk is the same. This is one thing I got them on the first debate. And since then, they have refined their argument. And they've come out with some papers that show certain asset types or companies are lower risk than others, depending on their carbon intensity and the type of fuel that they have, whether it be coal, coal being more risky than natural gas, for instance.
Yeah, so I think that's such an important point that we're going to come back to a couple times, I think, in this podcast, is that not all fossil fuels are equal in their carbon intensity. In fact, what I call the dynamic range of carbon intensity, even in just oil, is like 4 or 5 to 1. I mean, the lowest carbon intensity for extracting oil is, I don't know, what is it, 35
kilograms of CO2 per barrel?
Per barrel, yeah. All the way up to 100 plus, right?
That's right, yeah. So there are certain assets that in a low carbon world would have a much higher carbon cost and, potentially could be stranded depending on how high the carbon cost would go. But then there's other assets that are different. And that's one thing that their initial research just did not acknowledge.
Yeah.
That the risk is not the same in every company that you invest in.
No, it isn't. And so the divestment movement really started out of that paper, didn't it?
Right. So, they were the ones that put out this academic research, but then it was taken by groups like 350.org and Fossil Free and many others that built the momentum around asking investors to divest of oil and gas with the argument that these are too risky, you need to divest. And that will they also argued would enable the world to get back on the track in terms of meeting our climate change challenge. Yeah. Because if no one invested in these companies, they wouldn't grow. And then, you know, we would not have as many fossil fuels in the future.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like get out of this stuff because these companies are going to go bankrupt. The ExxonMobils of the world, et cetera, et cetera. Electric vehicles and so on are going to clobber the market. And by the way, there's no way we can afford to burn all the assets underground that companies like Exxon have. Isn't that basically the argument?
Yeah. And then their argument is if we all divested, then there would be no oil and gas being produced. I think that's another flawed argument. We'll get into that. I do want to acknowledge, though, that there has been a positive effect, in my view, mm-hmm. from this divestment movement. Well, some have divested. Now, the reports by these groups say that about 1,000 institutions have divested from fossil fuels mm-hmm. due to their efforts. That's from their websites. So while some have, many have decided not to. And many of the largest institutional investors have decided not to. But the question that has been asked has caused many of these investors to question what they're investing in, how the companies that they invest in would cope in a lower carbon world. It's resulted in many oil and gas and fossil fuel producers, even coal companies, having to produce reports that show, you know, what their company would look like if we were in a world where demand was flat to declining mm-hmm. because of policy change. And it also has caused many companies to commit to targets to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, even voluntarily. And if you look at something like Shell is a great example. Shell has committed not only to reducing their upstream emissions over the coming decades, but also the emissions associated with their products when they're consumed.
Yeah, I think it's that. And it's also combined with the rapid drop in the price of oil, late 14, early 2015, that gave companies a real impetus to innovate aggressively to reduce their costs and in turn also reduce their emissions, because reducing costs in a resource business also means reducing emissions, because the primary input into extracting resources is energy and things like diesel engines and pickup trucks and what have you that burn fossil fuels, right? Compressors and so on. So divestment arguments, I totally agree with you, forced a sense of transparency on the carbon side. And the fall in the oil price actually forced a sense of urgency on the cost side. And the two things are perfectly aligned.
So you've got the alignment there that if you can reduce your energy use, you become more efficient. And the other thing that's happened is there's been a lot of focus on the methane. Now, I'd argue that one doesn't necessarily have the same payback. Mm-hmm. So some of the emissions that come from the oil and gas industry are due to methane molecules that are released to the atmosphere, not burned.
Like leaky pipes?
Leaky pipes and things like that. And so there's also been a lot of voluntary targets by big oil, Western oil companies, public oil companies to reduce that as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that is more cost, but recognizing that that's the direction companies and investors want them to go.
So what you're saying is, and I agree that there's been a positive benefit of all this pressure that has been put on the industry, increased transparency in terms of the emissions issue. But the sort of the stretch to saying that the entire fossil fuel industry is going bankrupt is a big leap.
Yeah, I don't think that's accurate. And I think, you know, companies like Shell, for example, I keep highlighting them because they've probably been the most aggressive. But not only are they reducing their emissions, they're actually investing in new energy and transitioning their company. And that's actually the fastest way, I believe, that the world's going to meet these very big challenges. We can't just expect that we put ExxonMobil and Shell out of business and that these new upstarts are going to rise up and be able to solve this challenge as fast as what we could do if the big companies were to transition.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to note, and we'll talk about this more when we get to the Economist magazine article, but if you take all the free market super majors like ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, ConocoPhillips, et cetera, they only represent what is like 10% of total oil production?
Around 10%.
10% of the oil production. They are the most transparent now because they're publicly traded and are being forced to, or not completely forced, they're also willingly now becoming more open about their operations. There's 90% that isn't under this umbrella, right? We've got some
About over 10 million barrels a day of crude oil coming from places like Russia and Saudi Arabia, where there's very little visibility.
The perception is ExxonMobil is the biggest oil company in the world, and it's not. Like, I think it's down the list. We've got Saudi Aramco. We've got Sinopec in China, which is huge. We've got the Russian companies. So it's, you know, none of these companies are as open about any of the stuff that they do. And so this notion of divestment is that you're trying to divest of the best, most transparent Western companies in the world and basically let 90% of the rest of the oil industry that is not transparent take the market share.
Well, and I think this is the same debate we have in Canada around, you know, let's deal with our climate change challenge by stopping to build a pipeline like the Trans Mountain project going to the West Coast. The reality is that's going to do nothing to change oil demand. All that's going to mean is Canada companies are smaller, but Russia or OPEC or someone else in the world will fill that void. And that's where the divestment movement has it wrong. You know, you divest of 10% of the market.
Yeah.
That just means the others, the competitors, fill in that market share.
Yeah.
And they don't rely on public markets necessarily to fund their growth.
No, they don't. They don't. So we'll come back to that because it's such an important point in terms of, again, getting back to your point, not every barrel of oil is equal in terms of carbon intensity, but it's also not equal in terms of the transparency of where it comes from and exactly how many emissions and other environmental metrics that went into producing that barrel of oil. But let's get back to that debate, which, you know, I really enjoyed. It was the question again was, are investors in fossil fuel companies doomed? You know, in other words, again, blanket statement, anybody who puts money into, say, an oil and gas company is doomed. And, you know, one of the opening arguments that I used was, listen, I mean, it is very difficult to put an energy system out of business. I mean, you know, we still burn wood. We've been burning wood as humans for 40,000 years.
It's actually coming back more in vogue now.
It's coming back more in vogue, more green. You know, if you're an investor in a wood pellet company, you're doing well. Thank you very much. It's not like you're doomed. So putting an energy system out of business and dooming all investors as a blanket statement is really naive. And then I came to coal. I am not a fan of coal at all. But the reality is we've been trying to get rid of this stuff for over 700 years. King Edward I in 1293 banned coal. So 700 years ago, it was actually banned. And, you know, I love the resolution that I've read in the books. This is, you know, the resolution at the time said, coal is corrupting the air with great stink and smoke to the detriment of health. So, you know, these environmental issues are nothing new. They're recurring over and over again in history with coal. And it, I said, I'm no fan of it, but we have to acknowledge the resiliency of energy systems and that actually the best performing energy stocks today in the last couple of years, surprisingly, are coal stocks. And I pointed that out. I'm not necessarily saying I'm happy about that, but there you go.
So you're saying if you go back 4 years, they've increased their value, coal stocks, more than
like
oil and gas?
Like if you bought a coal ETF 4 years ago, you'd be up 2.5 times. That is more than any other indices, whether solar, wind, oil, gas. Like it's so, you know, this idea that you can put an energy system out of business rapidly is, in my opinion, a non-starter. And yeah, I acknowledge that if you are an over-leveraged company that is not innovating, you are going to go out of business. Over leverage, not innovating. Well, that's true in any business. Like try retail, try manufacturing, try entertainment. I don't know, like Blockbuster Video. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But so that doesn't mean that companies that are run well, that are trying to improve, in this case, their environmental performance through reduction of carbon emissions and their cost performance, I believe those companies are going to do exceptionally well.
Well, I want to go back to the coal thing because some people will be like, I don't believe that. But actually, if you go back a little further, coal equities had a massive fall, I think, in from the 2010, after the financial crisis, right?
Yeah.
There was this view that China was going to need coal forever. It was going to be a hockey stick forever. And, and there was a lot of investment made in coal. There was a surplus capacity after the financial crisis. And a lot of those equities did fall pretty far. Now you're saying they're up from those lows.
They're up from the lows. Yeah. They're up from the lows. Admittedly, they did fall. But it's a cyclical business like any other. And when you have a commodity price fall, it cleans out those companies that have too much debt and are not at the top of their game because they probably, and I think this is true in the coal business, some of the ones that went bankrupt, they bought other coal companies at the peak of the market.
Yeah, a lot of the bankruptcies resulted in
right.
when we had this belief that coal was going to grow forever and there was a lot of high valuations at the time.
Yeah, but I don't want to belabor coal because, you know, the notion is for the affirmative to this debate is that, okay, we're not talking about coal, let's talk about oil, which is the subject of the day, that over the course of the next 20 years, demand is going to fall by about 20%. Now, you know, you and I have debated this. We've run the numbers. 20% in 20 years is pretty aggressive, but we wouldn't debate, you and I, that oil demand is going to peak sometime in the next 20 years, right? But I said, you know, it's not really whether we're consuming 80 million, 90 million, or 100 million barrels a day. It's, you know, who's left producing that staggering amount of oil. That's really the important thing, number one. Number two, I pointed out that actually an even more aggressive slide in oil demand occurred between 1979 and 1983. Actually, in four short years, oil demand fell by 10% in the wake of the oil price shocks. And the substitutes at that time were coal in the electric power market and nuclear power, which was the new kid on the block, mm-hmm. much like renewables are the new kid on the block today. And so we've seen this movie before, and it has not ended in doom for all investors in oil and gas. Now, I can tell you, being a career starter in the 1980s, I started my career in the 1980s. I remember, oil and gas companies who got caught in that went under because they had too much debt and because they weren't innovating to adapt to the situation.
But you can also find companies in that period that actually grew their cash flow per share over that whole period. And I would come back to the coal example. You can actually find, and coal, the drop in demand in that period of 2010-11 was like 20% or greater.
Yeah.
But you had companies that actually returned value to shareholders through that period as well.
They do.
So yeah, you can find winners amongst that group. There's still a demand for these products.
Right.
Someone's going to be supplying it.
Right.
And so that's probably, you know, it doesn't like the demand goes to zero.
It's not like the demand goes to zero. But, you know, my third point in all this is that the oil and gas companies, let's put the coal companies aside, the oil and gas companies have to innovate to improve their product. In other words, a lower carbon product, and lower their costs to stay in the game going forward. You and I talked about that many times, and those are going to be the companies that innovate and do very well going forward to supply, whether it's at 80 million, 90 million, or 100 million barrels a day. But the real point is that, you know, investors don't sit still. They innovate and adapt to the situation too. The investors look at the landscape and say, okay, that's a good company that can withstand this downturn, and that's not a good company. The ones that don't recognize it, of course, are doomed. They will lose a lot of money. But I sense that savvy investors today are actually adapting to the new situation. They're looking at companies and saying, you know what? I'm looking at your company. If you've got old assets that have the potential to be stranded, yeah, I'm not going to give you any money. But if you're a company that is got faster payback on projects, is improving its carbon intensity, is setting itself up with efficient supply chains that tap into the markets and displace higher carbon, you're going to be one of the winning companies of the future and a winning investor.
What happened in the debate? How did your opponent from Carbon Tracker argue against some of those points?
Well, you know, he had his arguments with metaphors in the European electrical power industry, which rapidly lost a lot of value, and I accept that. In many ways, we agreed on a lot of things, to be honest. It was a really healthy exchange of ideas, not only for both of us, but also for the audience. And at the end of the day, though, I think the audience, you know, recognized the, I'll call it sort of the brashness of the resolution, which effectively implies that all investors in fossil fuels, in all fossil fuels, are doomed
in every company
in short order. And so, you know, at the end of the day, the poll was taken before the debate and after the debate, and I moved the needle by about 7%, and so I won the debate and the resolution. But I think, you know, I don't want to gloat over that because I think it was a really healthy exchange.
What was the actual, like, in terms of the polling in the room, how many people were on board with the divestment debate in total before and after?
Yeah, you know, recognizing this was largely a renewable energy, sort of green finance crowd. Before the debate started, it was 51-49, I think, in my opponent's favor. And by the end of it, it was, I think, 57-43 in my favor. So, you know, we sort of moved some ideas, but to me, that was moot. I think we need more of these sorts of debates because it gets to our next subject, which is The Economist magazine. I've been reading that magazine for, I don't know, 30 years, and I was really kind of disappointed in kind of the coverage and the sort of the naiveness of what they're saying, especially as it comes to ExxonMobil growing its production and how, you know, that's really such a bad thing for the world.
Yeah, let's back up. First of all, I do like The Economist. You know, I keep reading it. But when it comes to their coverage of the oil and gas industry, especially as it relates to climate change, I can't say I'm really that happy with their coverage. Like, I go back in time, right? Like in 2003, that they had the cover that shows that, you know, it's the end of the oil age. And 2017, they dedicated quite a few issues to electric cars. And they had one title called Roadkill, showing a battered internal combustion engine left on the ground. And they had all their arguments to why EVs were coming a lot faster than we thought. It would affect oil demand. And then, of course, now this most recent article. If you haven't seen the cover, it's worth seeing. It shows like a hand coming out of an oil pool, all covered in oil. Like, you know, like the...
Some horror movie, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're really good with the graphics. But, you know, I think they definitely had a lot of their arguments wrong, as they have on many of their previous articles when it comes to the oil and gas industry.
Yeah. I mean, one of their central arguments is, you know, ExxonMobil is growing its production in the Permian Basin, and there, you know, the implication is that world oil production is going to grow in its entirety. But this is really, and by the way, I'm not a shill for ExxonMobil. I'm just saying that it is part of that group of companies that is the most transparent in the world. You know, we've got 90% of the companies that do not report their detailed environmental record. What's really happening with the Permian is that the transparent companies in the world that are innovating, like the Shells and others, are taking market share away from the less environmentally compliant in the world.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental theory here is that ExxonMobil is growing by 25% between now and 2025, and that is a disaster for the world because we won't be able to address our climate change issues. And so, you know, there's so many problems with that argument, because the reality is that growth will come from other players, right? ExxonMobil, in fact, they even say in their article, Chevron, Exxon, Shell, BP, and Total are only 10% of all production.
Yeah.
So to think that, you know, if Exxon grew or they didn't, that would change world oil demand is a real mistake. And they talk about the fact there's no way to stop ExxonMobil because, you know, the court cases haven't been successful. There's been court challenges trying to stop it. The divestment movement hasn't been successful. The only way to do it, they believe, is for policymakers to step in and put constraints on Western oil and gas companies to stop their growth.
Well, I mean, this is ridiculous disservice to the world. I mean, we're trying to stop the most transparent, best operated companies in the world, right? That 10%. And 90% then can just get away and through high levels of corruption in many of these other oil-producing countries. And by the way, corruption and environmental degradation are tightly correlated. That's academically shown. So why is it that, you know, we want to put out of business the most desirable side of the supply chain and allow the most undesirable to take market share? I don't get it.
Yeah. And you know, they talk in one sentence, they mention that 85% of cars are still expected to be combustion engines in 2030. But they never talk about, well, why isn't policy trying to change that?
Yeah.
Or why don't we divest of automakers, or policymakers come in and say, hey, automakers, you have to make your cars way more efficient. By the way, Trump, as you know, has rolled back a lot of the efficiency standards in the United States for cars.
Yeah.
Like, that has a bigger implication for global oil demand than putting a policy to stop growth of Exxon.
Yeah, and I think that this gets back to, you know, something I brought up at the debates. And I said, why are we even debating who makes money and who doesn't in this space, particularly with the 10% that's under the free market? Like, why are we debating this? I thought the goal was to reduce emissions, right? And now the objective has shifted to, let's put the oil and gas business out of business with divestment. Like, you know, the point I made is, putting a resource industry out of business is far more difficult than the objective of reducing emissions collectively through collaboration, right? It has been shown historically over and over again. I gave you the coal example from 700 years ago. It is exceedingly difficult to put an energy system out of business. There's very few examples, one of which is the whale oil industry. Okay, that's one.
But it truly did run out of supply.
Yeah, it truly did run out of supply. Yeah.
Here, by the way, this is the naive point here, is that the belief that there isn't very much oil in the world. You know, if I just look at OPEC and Russia, if you look at some data from WoodMac, they have over 50 million barrels a day of future production that they haven't even developed yet. Like, there is a lot of oil in these countries that could fill in the gap if we shut down ExxonMobil or some of these others.
No, and I mean, do we really want more Russian oil that is developed in Russian oil fields where we have no transparency? I mean, convince me that Vladimir Putin is going to abide by the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, and then actually subject us to more geopolitical issues as we become more and more reliant on countries like Russia and the Middle East for our energy because we haven't changed our demand.
It's just you know, convince me that an oligarch is going to work hard to cut their emissions in these Russian oil companies. And you know, it's not only Russia. I mean, there's many other countries in the world that frankly have really no environmental regard in terms of their resource development, certainly not transparent and as scrutinized as what we have here in the Western world.
Yeah, and there's another point they bring up I want to raise is they talk about the fact it's important, you know, these companies are talking the talk now. You know, they acknowledge the fact that some of them have made commitments around carbon reductions, but it's what they do that matters is what they say. And they talk about the fact that they're making very small investments in renewables and alternative energy. And I just don't think that's fair. I'll bring back Shell for an example. They're spending about $2 billion per year on their new energy investing, and they plan to ramp that up to $4 billion by 2020, like in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Now, their total CapEx is still around $20 billion. So they're talking about moving almost like a quarter of all of their spending. That's real money and real investment being made that is going to contribute to helping us meet these big challenges. If you think about Russia, you know, do you think their oil companies are going to invest a quarter of the CapEx that they're making, or the money they're making from their oil business? Do you think a quarter of that's going to go towards developing the technologies that we need to address climate change challenge?
No, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, I think if we sort of summarize all of this, again, let's get back to the objective of reducing emissions, right? And let's not focus on the small, I'm going to call it small, but the upstream segment of the oil supply chain, ignore all the rest of it, you know, the downstream emissions, which are 80% of it. And let's just get back to the goal.
I totally agree. Well, that was a good rant. A rant at The Economist, which is always a fun thing to do. But it is important because, you know, a lot of people read The Economist. So, you know, hopefully there can be more balanced discussion in these very important journals in terms of what the real solutions are to climate change.
You know, I really would like them to write an article about who should supply that 80, 90 million barrels a day, which we are still going to be consuming in, we'll say, 20 years, by 2040. Okay, it's you know, the most aggressive decline estimates by these environmental agents still acknowledge that at least 80 million barrels per day are going to be used. And I just keep coming back to that. Who should be supplying it? Who do we want to be supplying it? And the answer to me is the most responsible, lowest carbon emitting companies. And those companies that are working toward that goal are in the Western world in that 10%. Of total oil production.
Well, and you know, they bring up a point that, by the way, many people would say that's not good enough, that what you just told me, that 20% reduction by 2040, because the IPCC says we need to drop by 20% to 2030 and 55% by 2050. It has to be faster. Okay, well, if that's your perspective, then you should be focusing on demand, because focusing on, you know, shutting down ExxonMobil is not going to get you to this goal. No. There has to be a real effort on what are we going to do to make our vehicles more efficient, to encourage electric vehicles, to make things happen faster than most of those forecasts think it's going to happen.
Yeah, 80 million, even 75. I just say, great, bring it on. There's going to be people that are going to make money, regardless of whatever that endpoint number is. And the people that we want to make money are the ones that are the most responsible producers. And guess what? I think it goes together. The most responsible producers will be the one that will make the money. And therefore, investors in those companies are not doomed.
And they will not be doomed. That was a great discussion. And thank you, our audience, for joining us once again on the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. Please rate us if you enjoyed the podcast, and also tell someone else about us.
Yeah, thank you.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.